premier radio networks presents Coast to Coast AM. And now, filling in for Art Bell, here is Barbara Simpson.
Barbara Simpson here with you on Coast to Coast AM on this Saturday into Sunday morning. Art is off tonight. He and Ramona are back east to the special preview of the film, which will be opening this week. So you'll all get a chance to see it, too. When he comes back, he'll give us a great description of what it was like. Exciting, I'm sure. I've seen all the commercials for it, and that sort of gives you goosebumps. Want to see it myself. Got a quote here. What appears to be the future for some is already the past for others who are unfolding it into the present. What does that mean? Well, we'll find out from the man who said it. His name is Charles Ostman. He's an expert in the area of nanotechnology and nanobiology, getting into consciousness and the issue of implants and the future that is not science fiction, the future that is here today. We better know about it, and we will, as we listen right here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. I want to tell you about our guest, but before we do that, just want to give you a quick update. The question came up in the last hour by one of the callers of how much we were getting selling the Alaska pipeline oil per barrel. And I said I wasn't certain. I knew that the price last quoted was around $40 a barrel. According to Don from Renton, Washington, he sent me a fast blast and said that according to the Alaska Journal, we are getting $42.20 a barrel right now. So that's within the time frame. And the understanding is a lot of it is getting sold to Japan. But just to bring it up to date, because I said we would check. Charles Ostman is our guest on Coast, and a fascinating guy and a fascinating subject that he deals with. He is currently a senior fellow at the Institute for Global Futures. He's also vice president and chair of the Nanoelectronics and Photonics Forum of NanoSIG, which is a nonprofit organization. He's also a senior consultant with the Strategic Synergy Group. He's an active participant with the Millennium Project for Global Futures Studies and Research of the American Council for the United Nations University. It's sort of a futures research think tank. He's also on the Scientific Advisory Board of Legendary Pharmaceuticals. That's a privately held company. Charles Ostman has 25-plus years of experience in the fields of electronics, physics, material science, computing, and artificial intelligence, including 8 years at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory at the University of California in Berkeley, not too far from where I am, and also Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. He's authored numerous technical papers and published articles. He lectures frequently around the country and abroad and has contributed content featured in a number of books. He's been featured in various nationally broadcast television appearances, ranging from PBS television to the Sci-Fi Channel. He's presented and published papers at numerous conferences and symposia. And I could just go on and on and on, but I won't. What I will do is introduce him and welcome Charles Ostman to Coast to Coast. Hello, Charles.
Greetings, Barbara. It's wonderful to have a chat with you. I've listened to you for many years, and here we are on the air together. It's great.
Here we are together again at last. I appreciate it. Listen, you have, I've got a quote from you, and I must admit, I don't understand most of it. So let me read it, and then we can start talking about what it is. What do you do? Quote, his current primary interests are in characterizing the process dynamics of the emergent nanotech, biotech, infotech, cognotech, operational ecology as the primary engine driving our next increment of collectic evolutionary morphology, and the convergence of quantum physics, biophysics, and focused intentionality shaping our potential future history, unquote. Charles, what does that mean?
That could be a two-hour lecture. And in fact, I was at the Institute for Noetic Sciences where I gave that very lecture, so I'll try to shrink it down to like a few seconds maybe.
Give us a thumbnail, and we've got plenty of time to pursue it, so
sure.
Go ahead.
The basic concept is this, and by the way, the concept of NBIC, or Nano Info Biocognitech, is not my invention. There's in fact a conference that's held every year, which is in part supported by the National Science Foundation and is chaired by Mihail Rocha, who also chairs the National Nanotechnology Initiative. So there's a lot of folks who sort of see the same general phenomena taking place. But the basic idea is this, that we are at a convergence threshold. In fact, I've talked a lot about what I refer to as the convergence syndrome, where all these different scientific disciplines, as well as what you might call philosophical disciplines, are sort of converging at the same time. And we're being pressed, sort of pressured in a way, to adapt to and to sort of change our way of viewing not just the world and not just us as a species, but really how we fit together the gigantic and ever-growing puzzle.
Yeah.
All these different separate domains of technology and interest, which are truly converging into a sort of a, I hate to use the word singularity, but in fact it is what it's becoming. And this is a type of evolutionary challenge that we have never faced before as a species that, in the history that we know of. And as I've often said to other people, it's kind of like the Apple computer ad where they used to say, think different. Well, my suggestion is we need to think holographically. In other words, a lot of folks tend to think of things, you know, sort of like one piece at a time or in a serial fashion. They look at one very narrow area of science or maybe one very narrow area of, say, policy development and think that's how they should see the world. But sadly, whether you like this or not, we're being adapted to a realm that says that's not good enough. We really do have to adapt to a much more systems approach to how we evaluate these new technologies and how they can be applied to our future. And this may, in fact, be a very good thing. I mean, I tend to hold the view, for instance, that evolution tends to be a trauma-induced process. And what I mean by that is, given that the periodicity and amplitude of the trauma cycles do not exceed the system's capacity to respond, the system does come back more robust. And this, in fact, can apply to intelligence, it can apply to sociological systems, it can apply to ecological systems, it applies to all different kinds of processes where evolution is the sort of a constant driver. That is, as long as there's a challenge to be confronted, then the response is to come up with a better way to adapt to the challenge and become more robust. So as a species, as a sort of a collective organism, we are now faced with a new kind of challenge, and that is to how to adapt to this ever more complex, convergence-driven world that we're trying to navigate our way through. And so the tools that we have to work with to help us get to this next evolutionary threshold are really quite spectacular. Nanotechnology, I think, is the most interesting from a manufacturing and sort of a physical enablement process, but it parallels quite directly with information and knowledge management. It certainly parallels very much with these sort of breakthroughs in biotechnology, which we can certainly touch on tonight.
Yeah.
And this leads to the next stage, which is now referred to by some as cognotechnology. And what does that really mean? Well, in terms of, and I can reflect a little bit on my past in the artificial intelligence world, the whole idea of what's called contextual cognition means that to cognize in the context of its surroundings, that is, to take a wide panorama of many different kinds of information, pull out the segments that are most relevant for the moment, and then contextualize those in the process of actually trying to evaluate what these things mean. Well, as is probably obvious to almost everybody now, we are facing a world where complexity keeps going up, time keeps shrinking downward, and the connectivity of all these different processes are sort of becoming ever more tightly ingrained. So that provides a new type of contextual cognition requirement in order to come up with new solutions to things, say, like energy, medical solutions, resource management, metascale economic processes. You know, the entire world is sort of connected now in a gigantic grid of sorts, and that grid is ever more dependent upon forms of processing which go far beyond the limitations of human cognition and require, not as an option, but as a requirement, a new type of cognitive process that's completely in the hands of machines that behave biologically. And I'll try to explain this as we go along.
Let me just ask you a question.
Sure.
I'm getting an understanding of what you're talking about, but at the same time that you're looking at this almost futuristically, we have a world in which people still live in huts in Africa.
Oh, yeah,
and other countries. So how do those people and their lives, which are very primitive, actually, certainly in comparison to what you're talking about, how does that all fit together?
Well, it does, but in ways that are kind of surprising. But I'll give you a few examples. I have a friend that, in fact, just came back from Kenya not too long ago, and believe it or not, there were people living in the bush, complete with their cattle and spears in hand, with cell phones. Mm-hmm. In other words, the rate at which the technology sort of dribbles into the, even the furthest corners of the world is happening at a rate which has never been experienced before. And, in fact, to give you the example of Africa, and also, for instance, I was in Brazil. I've been to Brazil a number of times, and I can remember quite distinctly being in the jungle 100 miles west of Manaus. I mean, truly, in the middle of the rainforest. And this was quite a few years ago. I had perfect cell reception. I mean, just pulled it out of my pocket. It was like I was talking to you as we are now. And the reasoning for this is that even though it's taken a long time for the quote-unquote Western world to develop the infrastructure for many different technologies, whether it's cell phone, wireless, different forms of travel, you know, all kinds of manufacturing processes and so on, once this infrastructure is developed, the process of transplanting it to other parts of the world is much quicker than the time it took to actually develop it from scratch to begin with.
Yeah, but what good is a cell phone if you don't have running water and sanitary facilities?
Well, and this is where the nanotechnology comes in. And it's okay to jump ahead, but I mean, I was sort of leading up to this. I was hoping to kind of give a logical sequence here.
Okay, go ahead.
The point being, for instance, water filtration, or let's say low-cost solar energy, or let's say, and this is probably going to be controversial, genetically modified foods that can grow in difficult situations, like in Africa, for instance, where the use of pesticides is really a serious problem. Starvation because of drought and other problems is becoming very, very bad. So is there a way to solve these problems using the current biotechnology that we have so that people can once again become not only self-sufficient, but in fact even become prosperous with the resources they have at hand? You know, these kinds of things, these are very tangible problems. In fact, this is what we do with the Millennium Institute. We look at exactly these kinds of things and try to pick out of this sort of Pandora's box of possible solutions how to best mix and match the solution to fit the situation at hand. But that's the point I'm trying to get at, is that we now have such a broad range of different kinds of sort of plug-and-play technical possibilities. It's very, very different than what it was maybe decades ago, where you had to take on one problem at a time and very slowly, kind of in serial fashion, kind of go through a series of boxes to kind of get to that final endpoint.
Right.
The process of delivery and the process of inventing solutions is very different than what it was even, say, a couple of decades ago. And that's the point I was hoping to make over the course of this conversation.
Where do we start with this kind of thing? Or are we so far into it already that we're just going to be almost moved along, in a sense, perhaps losing control over it?
Well, I have had this exact conversation many, many times. Some people have used the metaphor of, you know, being plankton in the ocean of life or something.
Yeah.
It's quite that severe. But I will admit to you, and I've actually written about this in the past, that we are, in a sense, like I said earlier, being pushed to a new kind of evolutionary threshold of sorts. I call it an event horizon because I see it as an irreversible threshold that we're crossing. But at the same time, rather than seeing it being taken along involuntarily like plankton, I see it almost more like a symbiotic process, where some people may think, oh my gosh, we're being pushed in this new technical paradigm and we're these involuntary, you know, sort of organisms in this gigantic process. Well, yes and no. Let me try a different kind of answer. A lot of people have argued in the past that because of these rapid changes in nanotech and biotech and now infotech sort of taking over our lives, that we're somehow violating nature, and this is like in somehow inverting the whole organic way the planet once was. Well, I tend to offer a different kind of viewpoint. Actually, this is part of nature. We are, in a sense, tool users. I mean, as an organism, as an anthropological entity, we have the ability to build tools, to organize, to create social systems, to construct our lives beyond the limitation of just living hand-to-mouth in the forest, as it were.
Right.
We simply have a larger set of tools, but this is still part of the nature. An example I often offer as a metaphor is, if you remember in the Arthur C. Clarke book that was later turned into a film, 2001 Space Odyssey, the opening part of the film shows the sort of ape-like hominids living around this pond, and then one of them reaches out towards the big obelisk that comes out of the ground and touches it, and spark. There's a spark of intelligence, supposedly from an alien source, whatever that was. And then the critter in question suddenly goes, aha, I have it now. I've learned something new. I can use tools. Now, sadly, the first thing he does, or she does, I'm not sure which, picks up a bone and crushes it in the head of his neighbor, which is a rather sad commentary for human development. But nonetheless, that was kind of a start point for showing.
Let me just say, we haven't changed a lot.
Sorry. I'm very sorry to say that we haven't. In fact, if we get to the point where I can talk about spiritual maturity, that's exactly where I'd like to go. But
okay.
Just a kind of metaphor of the film. Then he throws the bone up in the air, and you see the bone spinning about, and all of a sudden it morphs into the scene of the Pan Am orbital spacecraft, in modern times. Well, that's exactly where we are. We have the bone up in the air. It's spinning around. We have this vastly new set of tools to work with, but it's still part of the nature that we were born into. It is part of the evolutionary process that we adapt, refine, develop new tools, and hopefully, with some level of spiritual wisdom, apply these tools in a more benevolent fashion. Now, one thing I might say about the concept of war and all the bad things that we have done over the past, war has often been seen, not always, but often has been seen as a kind of a profit-bearing business enterprise. I mean, if you look at history throughout all the millennium, typically that's what it amounted to. I mean, certainly there were religious philosophies and other ideological philosophies applied to sort of motivate the soldiers in the field and the population, but the reality was, for the most part, the rulers in question, they just wanted to conquer some land, gain some new territory, enslave a population, you know, whatever the thing was they were hoping to do. Well, we've now entered an era where that doesn't really work anymore. I'm very glad we don't have any more world wars coming up, although, you know, very sadly we have the certain situation we have with the world of Islamist terrorists and that sort of thing. But nonetheless, I don't think that any major power really sees global warfare as a kind of a profit-producing enterprise. I think that we're sort of being pushed to an edge to say, okay, that was a certain kind of procedure that had a certain kind of outcome. The risks are too great. It's not really a good investment anymore. Maybe there are better ways to get at the end result of a better, more prosperous life, more goods and material for our country, et cetera, et cetera. It's kind of a strange way of putting this argument, but I'm suggesting that we are possibly, and I just use the word possibly, being poised on the edge of a new kind of way of looking at how to manage the world's affairs without having to resort to the traditional modality of warfare as being seen as the business venture it once was.
Let me ask you, just in light of what we're going through now, and not only this country, but certainly Western Europe as well, or the Western countries, is that if you follow the rationale that the militant Islamists are doing what they're doing in terms of terrorism in various countries around the world, because there are any number of conflicts around the world, and almost all of them involve the militant Muslims, their goal appears to be conversion of the infidel, as they call it, the non-believers, to their form of religion and belief in God and practice. That has nothing to do with conquering for land, per se. I mean, it may be part of it, but that doesn't seem to be the initial intent.
Well, I agree.
It's not even an army with uniforms that are associated with a country. It's a belief. So that is a different kind of war than the old-fashioned World War I and II.
It is indeed. And, in fact, it's a very sad remnant of a sort of a previous paradigm where the vast majority of the world really consisted of separate pockets of isolated societies with their own particular religious paradigm, and then whenever they clashed or came together, they would usually have a few wars to kind of settle out the differences and then figure out who owned what territory. But mm-hmm. back in those days, you could kind of afford the luxury, and I use that word kind of carefully here, of having a clumsy and sort of messy process to determine how that worked out. Sadly, we now live in a world where everything is so tightly interconnected and the risks are so great that there really isn't room for a logical, and I use that word, logical kind of a procedure to carry on war as a way to gain territory or value or goods. Well, I think we're seeing, I'm no expert in Islamic culture by any means, but what I think I'm seeing is a kind of a remnant or a leftover from an earlier time by people who are still living in their reference point as if they were still in the 14th or 15th century, because that's the kind of world that they had been familiar with up until very recently. And in fact, this kind of, unfortunately points to another area that I was going to bring up a bit later, but the rate of what I call process morphology, sorry for the buzzword, but all it means is the rate of change, but on a meta scale, is not evenly distributed throughout the world. In fact, this is one of the great challenges that we're faced with.
Okay, hold your thought right there, and we're going to take a break at the bottom of the hour. When we come back, let's pursue that, because I think that's the key to the dilemma we find ourselves in. We're fighting on one level, they're on another, and I'm not sure we can meet in the middle, and that's a worrisome thing. We're talking with Charles Hossman. I'm Barbara Simpson right here on Coast to Coast AM.
Somewhere out there, this is Coast to Coast AM. And now, filling in for Art Bell, here is Barbara Simpson.
That's me, Barbara Simpson, and we will continue our discussion of what the world is going to be like with nanotechnology and all the other technologies that are out there, how they'll affect our lives and the future, because it's already doing that right now. Our guest is Charles Hossman, but I just want to remind you about our After Dark newsletter, You Can Run, But You Cannot Hide. And in the June issue of the newsletter, you're going to find out what new and, well, actually old technology puts eyes in the sky for spying and surveillance, the likes of which we have never seen. Find out about that, plus the state of the world's petroleum supplies. You'll read about how life will change if we don't hurry up and find some alternative fuels. There's always that discussion. Plus, there's George's editorial. There's news. There's Lex Lonehood's funny column called Oddities, and so much more. Plus, don't forget the free CD of Malachi Martin. That offer ends June 18th. So call now 1-888-727-5505 and subscribe. It's $39.95 for 12 monthly issues, plus $2.95 shipping and handling for that classic CD. But as we said, that offer ends for certain on June 18th. Call toll-free 1-888-727-5505 or subscribe online at coasttocoastam.com. Just click through the secure server. We'll be right back. My guest is Charles Hossman and Barbara Simpson in for Art tonight on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking about nanotechnology and all the other technologies. And just before the bottom of the hour, we're talking about the situation of world war and that perhaps we have gone beyond the rationality of having a world war. But I raised the question with Charles about the kind of war on terrorism that we're fighting now with people who are really not from a country. It's a way of thinking, and as you said, Charles, that perhaps their position, mentally at least, is in the 14th and 15th century. How do we deal with that, and what do you see for the future on this type of situation?
This is probably one of the most difficult problems that anyone can attempt to wrestle with. I'm not sure I'm qualified to even offer an opinion or anyone else that has tried to look at this. I can only suggest that perhaps, and this is just a kind of a, I just offer this as a kind of a tangential thought, and this may segue into the next segment of what we're going to talk about. But if it were possible to really remarkably change how the distribution of resources, how the quality of life, how just life in general can be sort of brought to a more state of equilibrium,
And by that, I don't mean like in a socialism sense where you take from some and give to others. I don't mean that at all. I mean optimizing how we use our current resources and looking at new technologies to kind of provide a new kind of platform, if you will, to determine how resources are managed and how they're distributed. This may, in fact, relieve the tension or the pressure that breeds this kind of mania to begin with, because I think that a lot of times when you have people who are confined to extreme poverty or extreme difficulty or in an isolated realm socially and so forth, that is a perfect breeding ground for the kind of ideology which can be manifest in such extreme forms. So not to be too trying to reach for a conclusion here, but I'm just saying one way of looking at this is to say if we could turn around some of the difficulties that are facing a lot of the world's countries today, then the chance for this kind of ideology to take hold would be ever less so. That's just my 2 cents worth on that thought. But okay, having said this, one of the areas I'd like to tap into, if I may, mm-hmm, would be energy, because after all, I think that, to put it plainly, as we're finding out so painfully at this very moment, we've come to an end of a road in a way, in the sense that this idea that we have to be forever more myopically attached to petrol-based chemicals or sort of hydrocarbons as our singular major fuel source to drive the Western economy, et cetera, I think that this is long overdue for a change. Obviously, back in President Carter's time, there was an attempt to sort of look into alternative energy and alternative fuels, and it was sort of pushed for a bit, but then it kind of relaxed and was seen as a kind of obscure topic. Well, obviously, in today's world, we're getting a very clear sense of, gee, maybe we should really be changing this. As a matter of fact, I would like to offer the idea, kind of like back when JFK said, we're going to put people on the moon in 10 years.
Right.
Well, people laughed and said, oh, come on, you got to be kidding. Well, guess what? We had people on the moon in 10 years. What was interesting about that was that the technical challenges, the scientific thresholds that had to be crossed to make that possible, starting from scratch, were far more demanding and far more extreme than the reality of what we might be able to approach in adopting a new kind of energy policy in today's world. This is actually a much more doable thing. So I would submit to you that whoever becomes president, whether it's Bush or whoever else, that to me is less irrelevant than if we had a mission that the entire country could rally behind, that made good sense, that anybody from any political persuasion could say, you know, that sounds good. I think I'll get behind that. It would be a stimulus, a catalyst, if you will, to drive a new kind of goal. And that goal would be to say, okay, enough is enough. We're going to get out of this addiction to petroleum once and for all. Not, I mean, all everything at once overnight. I'm just saying as a transition, as a way to look at different kinds of alternative energies that can be put in piecemeal fashion into different transportation forms. And eventually, I think we'll see the day when cars probably do run off of hydrogen, and I can explain that in a little bit. That may be 10 or 12 years off, but we have to start now. I think that we really have to take seriously that we've come to a point where our geopolitical alliances, particularly with Saudi Arabia and so forth, which have been very questionable for years, and getting so caught up in this sort of milieu of very complicated politics, most of which would never have come to pass in the first place had we not been so focused on the oil that we have to use to survive and so forth. I think that we have a wonderful set of tools to work with if we choose to use them. And if the general public were perhaps a little more aware and more focused on making this a national mission, this could be really done. And I think that this could overcome the political limitations that some people perceive are getting in the way of this actually coming to pass.
Well, you know, just to play devil's advocate a little bit on this, part of the problem with our dependence on foreign oil is that because of the pressures of the environmentalist thinking, that we are precluded from drilling for oil in this country. In fact, there are many oil wells in this country which are capped, which are not being pumped because of the cost involved in it. Excuse me. And you also have the situation of people, you know, we use cars. And I don't think the average person really would care whether it's gasoline in the car that lets me go 60 miles an hour or whether it's something else. But the cost of the infrastructure, the cost of the vehicles, and the open market People don't buy them. So, you know, I mean, what you're talking about ultimately at this point would be heavy, heavy subsidies, which gets into taxation, which gets away from our free market system. It's
Not exactly. It's wonderful they made this point, because this is exactly what I ran to respond to, because I know this argument painfully well.
I bet you do.
So allow me to kind of offer a couple of alternatives, just as food for thought. Maybe this will help open up a different way of looking at this. For instance, Richard Smalley, who won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his development of carbon fullerenes, is one of the strongest proponents of the concept I'm now about to explain, which I've been, of course, very much interested in as well. And I think that many people, as they begin to hear the logic, go, okay, let's give this a second thought. So as an example, let's look at hydrogen. Now, a lot of people are looking at hydrogen and saying, well, how are you going to produce the hydrogen? It takes a lot of energy to actually manufacture hydrogen by splitting it out of water using electrolysis and so on. Well, yes and no. It depends on where you do it and how you do it. So as an example, there is a person by the name of Harry Braun, by the way, who's quite well known for his work in this area. He did work with Mark E. Lawton and a bunch of other folks. But the whole point I'm trying to get to is that it's possible, for instance, to use wind and also ocean currents to drive turbines. Those turbines would then create electricity. The water available at the open oceans would then produce hydrogen, which can then be stored in pressurized liquid gas container ships, just like they exist now. In other words, the infrastructure actually exists to do that much. The limitation comes in how do you get the hydrogen to be used safely at the consumer side. The example I might offer, by the way, is back in World War II, believe it or not, the Brits actually used hydrogen gas in their lorries in certain cases. The problem was that the engines actually run much better on hydrogen. They last longer, there's less wear and tear in the engine and so on, and the exhaust happens to be water. But
right.
The difficulty was, how do you store the hydrogen in a safe way? And this is a serious problem. If you store hydrogen under high pressure at 40,000 PSI or cryogenically, the problem is if you crash or have a slight accident and the tank ruptures, it's very, very bad. You'll leave a crater behind where there used to be a car. So this is not good.
No, it's not good.
However, there is another alternative, and I'd like to explain this. Nanotechnology, because it is a material science more than anything else, allows one to construct new kinds of materials that simply wouldn't be feasible in previous times. And now we're going to get back to Richard Smalley. The whole idea of using carbon nanofibers as a kind of a molecular sponge to then hold the hydrogen in place under relatively low pressure is actually a very exciting breakthrough. And in fact, there was a company right here in the Bay Area called Nanomics, and I know them quite well. They were doing this. This was actually an extension from some research that had been conducted at UCLA. And in fact, there's something called the CNSI, the California Nanosciences Institute, and they were doing some of this for a few years. This company picked up where they left off, was funded through some private VC money. They got pretty far, actually, and it's kind of a complicated story. I won't bore all the details, but they kind of changed in midstream because the VCs were getting a bit anxious for return on investment, and there were some management changes and so on. But what happened was Nanomics actually dropped the program and went into a much shorter-term sort of profit-bearing venture, that is to create biosensors for Homeland Security and that sort of thing. And the point, though, being that they had gotten as far as creating some sample vessels, which showed the viability of the concept. They had done some sample prototypes with various cars. They showed that this could be done if it were allowed to be funded for several more years and so on. Now, I think other people are looking at this. In fact, they're taking a very hard look at this. The reality is that if we could, in fact, solve the problem of a low cost, and that's the key word here, low cost and also a relatively safe way to store the hydrogen at the consumer side, this is like the last step, really, in a long chain of requirements, sort of a value chain, if you will, to make that infrastructure possible. It's not really as far away as some people might think. Now, over the past number of years, metal hydrides were used for this kind of low-pressure storage. The problem with the metal hydrides, however, was that they're quite expensive. They can only be cycled a certain number of times, and they lose their effectiveness. And they're also rather toxic when you try to dispose of them. So it was an interesting concept, but it wasn't quite ready for prime time. On the other hand, carbon nanofibers, which is a very recent development, this is just a handful of years now.
What are they?
Okay, carbon, well, there's a term called fullerenes. And fullerenes refer to carbon atoms as they line up in this hexagonal pattern and form certain kinds of shapes, be it tubes, rods, spheres. There's different kinds of shapes depending upon how these things are formed. But it's a molecular structure, and in fact, of all the different kinds of commoditized nanomaterials, this is probably the first that's going to become a serious major commodity, not just for fuel, but really for a whole bunch of reasons, for materials used in aircraft, for electronics. The range of applications is actually quite astonishing, but there are a number of companies right now today, I mean at this very minute, who are spending millions and millions of dollars to set up foundries to manufacture these carbon fullerenes of different types to provide the infrastructure for the industrial development of nanotechnology as a manufacturing process.
Now, is it like a fabric, or is it like a metal, or does it take different forms?
Well, that's a good question, and funny you should ask this, because I've been to Washington, D.C. a number of times, and one of the times I was in Washington, D.C., I was invited to sort of sit in on a panel that was kind of an attempt of sorts to create a new regulatory paradigm to see how was nanotechnology going to be regulated in the future. And it was interesting because there were all kinds of folks from NIOSH, OSHA, you know, various medical compliancy people, FDA, food and drug safety people. I mean, everything you could imagine, every agency you could possibly imagine was sort of there in some context. And then you have people like me who were brought in as kind of private sector advisors to say, okay, here's the industry I'm working with, or here's what we're doing, and how is the regulation going to affect me? So the very first thing that was brought up were carbon fullerenes. And here's the reason I make this point. Because carbon is one of the most common elements on Earth. It's everywhere. Life itself depends on it. It's inert. It has all these marvelous properties. However, when the carbon is treated a certain kind of way, it suddenly forms up in this hexagonal patterning that creates a lattice structure. And this lattice structure, again, depending upon how it's formed in the furnace, or there's different ways of manufacturing the fullerenes, but it creates this very, very beautiful and very specific kind of a structure. It does not really happen in nature, but it can happen if the carbon is treated a certain kind of way in a foundry process. This has invented a whole new kind of chemistry that's never really existed before. So while I was sitting in on this panel trying to decide how to deal with nanotech regulation in the future, the first thing that was brought up was carbon fullerenes. And so I asked the question, I said, well, I mean, after all, you're looking at a molecule, but it's not really a molecule that occurs in nature. It's a device of sorts because it's used as a sort of a mechanical component in many different kinds of materials that are being fabricated now, but it can also be used in some cases for drug delivery. It can be used in medical applications. It can also be used in electronics. So what are you trying to regulate? And nobody had an idea. In other words, they didn't know what to define. It's not a chemical exactly. It's not a machine exactly. It's not a medical something, but it could be applied in all those areas. And this was a simple one. There are much more complex ones which are being looked at, organometallics, dendrimers, a whole range of zeolites, a whole bunch of these things which are coming into the pipeline very quickly. The carbon materials are just the first one in a whole series of these. But the point is, as we look at this new type of sort of a mixture between chemistry and materials and physics, it's a yet-to-be-determined arena that decides how they can be even described from a regulatory perspective. But the reason I bring that up is because this is the very start point of a whole range of industries which are very quickly going to be adapting this kind of manufacturing process to create the materials that will become useful for things like perhaps hydrogen storage in the future.
Hmm. So it really is coming up with, as you said, a new material, and then just following through, I guess, following your imagination to see how you can use it to make things better and easier and perhaps more efficient and less expensive.
More efficient, less expensive, and I'll throw a couple new ones in. For instance, just imagine for a moment, let me start by saying how I define nanotechnology, because there's a lot of confusion. There's been a tremendous amount of publications coming out, some of which were sort of dark and foreboding and talking about gray goo and replicators and nanites on the loose. And, of course, Michael Crichton had his book, Prey, which was a little bit on the dark side. A fun read, but I thought it was hopelessly unrealistic, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Other people like Bill Joy, who I have tremendous respect for, a wonderful scientist and absolutely intelligent and well-meaning fellow, who kind of published this article that came out in Wired a few years ago where he said, well, we're on the edge of this somewhat uncertain realm where we're opening up the Pandora's box of nanotech, and its ultimate form may release this sort of replicating molecular stuff that we don't really understand how it works, but we produce it and then it sort of gets loose. Well, I'm not buying into that exactly. I think that if there are some areas of biotech where if things got a little bit out of hand, yes, there are some biological things I might be curious about and, you know, worried about. But I, from a materials perspective, we're so far away from having sort of replicating nanites in the loose. This is way off in the future. I'm talking about nanotech in today's current form in a very practical sense. After all, I work with a lot of VCs and patent attorneys and people who are looking at the business side of nanotechnology, so I have to sort of confine myself to the reality of what really is here and how we're using it. But that in itself is fascinating enough. There's no need to add fiction. I think the reality is interesting as it is. So what I'm hoping to suggest is that, just think for a moment, if one could print matter, kind of like printing ink on paper, only you print matter on a surface to create some object or a structure that you're looking for, as an inexpensive, granular, just-as-needed kind of manufacturing process. In fact, there's a whole new industry coming up called nanoprinting, which is exactly that. You print the chemistry of choice onto the surface of your choice, and then through a process called complementary chemistry, those first set of molecules can attract other molecules, and that starts a kind of an assembly process. So in a sense, you could, like, grow a computer chip, or you could create a complex device like a sensor or other things in a way that simply wouldn't be possible even a few years ago using a desktop piece of machinery, something that you actually
wow.
put into an office. I mean, that's
it's almost like taking on a life of its own, isn't it?
In a sense, yes.
Yeah.
The reason I bring this up is because, in my perspective, from a material science perspective, it's the ordered patterning of matter at the molecular scale of precision to suit an engineering problem. That is
okay.
my definition of nanotechnology.
Hold your thought right there, because we're at the top of the hour. We will come back and pursue this further with my guest, Charles Ostman. It really is the world of the future, but it's here right now. I'm Barbara Simpson. This is Coast to Coast AM.
How high will gas prices go this summer? How